Welcome to Lost in Transformation. This is Ming Labs, podcasting from Singapore, an international innovation center, business hub, and startup supporter. Learn from digital thought leaders and designers about innovation and transformation of businesses in an ever-evolving digital world. Coming up is your host, Sebastian Miller, co-founder and COO of Ming Labs, with our guest for today, Tom Richardson. Tom is the Managing Director of Asia Pacific at Envision App, the enterprise design platform. Tom has been working in high-growth tech startup leadership roles for the past 7 years, after 4 years at WPP, the world's largest marketing communications firm. He now lives in Sydney, Australia, and speaks fluent Japanese. We hope you enjoy the conversation and look forward to your feedback.
Tom, thank you very much for taking the time.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
So maybe let's just start a little bit with your background, so yeah, the listeners can also understand a bit where you come from in that way. What have you been doing in the past? What was your journey like? And how have you actually now come to Envision?
Yeah. No, so it's been a very unusual career path. When I was interviewing for my role with Envision, I was speaking to a few different companies, and one of the comments that I got a lot was, you know, that my history and my career history makes no sense logically, because I've done so many different things which don't necessarily line up in a single path, but have all contributed to where I got to today. So I graduated in the UK in 2007 and went to Tokyo for 2 years and lived in Japan. I was on a scholarship from the Daiwa Foundation. The Daiwa Foundation is a charitable organization set up by Daiwa Securities, the investment bank. Yeah. And the idea is that they send between 8 and 10 British citizens every year to Tokyo for 19 months. And you learn Japanese in a very good Japanese language school in Tokyo for a year. You do a month's homestay with a Japanese family, and then you work in a Japanese business environment for 6 months in Japanese. So I was very privileged to have a chance to learn Japanese all day, every day, because a lot of people who move to Asia and want to learn the language, local language, have to work during the day. And so it's very difficult with families and other commitments to make that happen. But I was given a year of pure focus on becoming as good as I could be at Japanese. And so through Daiwa Foundation's connections, I ended up working at the Tokyo 2016 Olympic Bid Committee in an international communications role. And that lasted a year. And then I came back to London, applied to a program called the WPP Fellowship. The fellowship is essentially a 3-year rotation program set up by WPP, the world's largest marketing and communications company. And the idea is to give young people coming out of graduate or near graduate roles an opportunity to travel the world and work in different parts of WPP's business, and then fast track them into a management position when the program finishes. And so I spent a year in London in market research, a year in Shanghai in digital marketing, working with the North Face and Huggies and SC Johnson in the Chinese market, and then moved to California with a brief stop in England in between to get married. And my new wife and I moved out to California in 2012 and finished the program there. And then through my work with WPP, I actually met a company called Acquia. Acquia is a software company in the web content management business. So we competed with the likes of Adobe and Sitecore in helping big companies build big websites. And I was very happy doing that. I moved to Boston with my family to join Acquia in the US, spent 5 great years at Acquia. And then in May of this year, having been working with Envision as an advisor for about a year previously, the opportunity finally came up to move to a role full-time with Envision. And it was a fantastic opportunity. I actually called up my now boss, Ryan, the SVP of International Envision, to talk to him about the potential for moving into a role at Envision when it was clear that, you know, my time at Acquia was up. And he's based in London and I'm originally from England. So I was fully expecting that he would say to me, yeah, we have something, you know, opportunity for you to come to London, come and work with us on the international business, and you can travel and help us use your international experience in building that out. But he said to me, you know, we don't actually have an opportunity in Europe right now, but we really need someone to come in. And we're increasingly thinking we need somebody to come in and run the Asia Pacific business for Envision. So it took me about 2 seconds to think about it. And immediately it was something that was very clear to me that I really wanted to do. And, you know, I have a history of living in Southeast Asia, East Asia, and very passionate about doing business in this part of the world. And my wife's Australian, so the opportunity to move to Sydney came up as well. Yeah. And that's been fantastic for our family. And so here I am, you know, 6 weeks into the role with Envision, and loving every minute so far.
That's great. Maybe for a bit of a background on Envision itself, what is Envision actually all about? What's the mission behind the company?
Yeah, so Envision is an eight-year-old company. It was founded in 2011. And it was founded by two folks, Ben and Clark, who came out of an agency background. And when they were working on design in an agency context, they were very frustrated by how difficult it was to share their design work collaboratively with customers and with other stakeholders in the design process. And they felt that there must be a better way of doing that. And they started Envision in 2011 and very quickly attracted a very strong organic user base. And what was exciting about it is it was not just, you know, hobbyists, but it was, they started seeing, you know, domains like uber.com and netflix.com and so forth, people signing up to use their products, getting validation from some of the most design forward companies in the world. Following on from that, obviously, venture capital investors took a big interest in the company. So far to date, Envision's raised about $325 million in venture capital. We have over $100 million in revenue. And what our platform entails today is really a collaborative design platform that allows you to go through the entire design process and product development process, from coming up with an idea in the first place through to pushing that into production and testing and giving feedback. So it's a very different product now than it was 8 years ago. It's more of a platform now with multiple different products under that umbrella. But we now work with 100% of the Fortune 100. Envision is everywhere. We have 5 million users worldwide. The Asia Pacific business is growing at 100% year over year. So we're in a very privileged position. And now it's really an imperative that we take advantage of this, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity we have to build something incredible in this region and globally.
That's fantastic. I think as Envision, from what I've seen so far, also from all of your events, you're in touch with a lot of the design leaders here in the region at large companies, but also at fast-growing startups. In terms of the design maturity in Southeast Asia, where do you see the market here? And is there a difference between the different countries?
Yeah. So I guess there's two questions bound up within that. It's very interesting questions. I think they're, firstly, APAC, which is my role as managing director for Asia Pacific. And APAC is really a shorthand for, as you guys know, a very large number of very different countries and very different cultures, different business contexts. And so firstly, understanding that is very important. You know, it makes sense for an American business entering into Asia Pacific to think about the market in that way. But I think that we have to be very careful to adapt regionally based on the different markets in Asia Pacific. In terms of design maturity, I get asked this question a lot. And it's fascinating because I think that in many of the markets in APAC more broadly, if you look at particularly China, Thailand, Vietnam, to a lesser extent, Singapore and Australia, what's happening is that there's this kind of emergence of this new cohort of digital first giant companies that have kind of skipped a generation in the evolution of their respective categories. So if you look at, you know, Alibaba and WeChat and so forth, WePay, Grab here in Singapore, these are companies that haven't necessarily had to go through the kind of painful, difficult design, digital transformation processes that more conservative companies in more conservative categories have had to go through in, let's say, you know, the US or European markets. Yeah. In some respects, with the kind of explosion of mobile over the last 15 years or so, a lot of these markets are starting to think about doing fundamental things like getting a loan, paying for your bills, ordering food, getting a, you know, cell phone plan completely through mobile from day one. So they haven't had to go through, you know, the same process that some of the more established legacy industries in the US have had to go through to kind of reinvent themselves. It's almost like the incumbent has been completely reinvented from the ground up with the advent of mobile. And I think that's created a very design forward culture across Asia Pacific in general. And I think the expectations for the user around things like financial services, around things like utilities, around things like transportation, etc., very different on account of having grown up in many cases with this new world order.
So in terms of then maybe the conversations that you're having here, and I guess you talk a lot to your customer base about the issues that they're facing, to also then, I guess, find new inspiration or ways of helping them. Do you then see differences in the kinds of problems and issues that would come up here, whereas in the US, for example, do people think about different things? Do they have different problems in the design process and how they think about the organization?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think that the problems are somewhat universal, and it's always a shortage of talent. It doesn't matter which market you're in. It's always hard to find experienced designers, UX designers who, not astronomically expensive, but also very capable of doing what's required. Right. That's consistent across the US, across Europe, very acute here in Singapore, particularly because the emergence of big local digital first companies like Grab, those are companies that are very competitive in the war for talent. And so it can be difficult if you are trying to establish a design practice in a more conservative company to poach folks from those organizations. So talent is obviously a big one. The other universal one is the ability to explain the value of design at a board level or an executive level in an organization. I think that a lot of people in leadership positions, C-level leadership positions, will say that conceptually they understand why design matters, and they understand that it's not a coincidence that Airbnb has been so successful so quickly and that design plays a big role in that, for example. Yeah. But being willing to recognize that versus being willing to do the hard yards to really dig in and transform the way your company operates, the way it thinks, the way it allocates budget is a very different problem. And so a lot of the design leaders we talk to are asking us, who have you seen transform really effectively? So one of the things that we see a lot is companies asking us how other companies that we work with are doing things well and wanting to understand best practices, how they're explaining the value of design from a commercial standpoint to the executives who are deciding on budget allocation and so forth. That's very much a universal thing. And then, just from, I guess, like some of the less universal things are specifically related to some of the kind of infrastructure related components of doing business in Southeast Asia. So you have, in many cases, Envision is involved in a world where people are creating very high fidelity prototypes. They're doing advanced animation work from a design point of view. And, being able to do that kind of work with a rural 2G, 3G connection can be difficult. Obviously the majority of our customers in our case are not, they're centrally located in big metropolises, but their end users are in many cases a huge explosion of growth of mobile. We talked about that's often the uptake is really in more rural areas where you're thinking about particularly internet speed and performance is a big issue and accessibility. So that's one thing that I think has some peculiarities and some peculiar characteristics about operating in this market. And I often think about something I was told about how Facebook being an entirely global company now, more than a billion users worldwide, they have, I think, a day a month where Facebook turns the entire Wi-Fi connection in Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park into a 2G connection so that everyone working on product is forced to empathize with the user about what it's like to be trying to access Facebook on this connection. So I heard that secondhand, but whether or not it's entirely accurate, it's a really interesting insight into how some of the most sophisticated companies in the world from a design point of view think not just about design as a screen design, but more about experience and interaction and how people will experience the product that they're building.
Yeah, these points are absolutely valuable. I mean, we've seen this in our work a lot when we do things for farmers in Indonesia, or we work in the countryside of Malaysia. Does that for you then, this kind of feedback and these kinds of insights lead to any difference or modification in the types of tools that you provide? Is there any then features that you create based on that, or maybe even variations for local markets?
Yeah, so I think that one of the really interesting things happening in design tooling right now is that there is this kind of tension between the rush to the cloud versus the native application. And Envision, when it was founded in 2011, was essentially a native application that you downloaded to your desktop and then you would run on your local device, because to do the kind of advanced prototyping and design work that you can do with Envision, it wasn't possible in the browser at that time.
Yeah.
There are now businesses that are starting to come up and compete with Envision that I give you that ability to collaborate in real time in the browser using an internet connection to do some more sophisticated things, maybe not at the level of advanced animation that Envision is operating in, but a fairly high level of sophistication in design. So we hear from a lot of customers and this is obviously at the customer user side rather than the end user of the product the customers are building, but a lot of customers are torn between wanting to move into the future with browser-based, cloud-based solutions versus a recognition that if they are on an airplane or they're on a, you know, a train in India or Thailand or Indonesia or whatever it might be, that they want to be able to continue to, you know, be using the product. And right. they may not have the ability to do that if it's fully browser and Wi-Fi based. So one example of, think of kind of the way in which big momentous trends in the design software market are being somewhat impacted by local context. I think from the end user standpoint, we give you the ability to design at any level of sophistication you want, from a very, very simple, you know, UX sketch through to extremely sophisticated kind of multimedia advanced animation prototypes. And so we're not necessarily designing products for the end user or via our customers for the end user that make design work more accessible, simply because it's really up to the customer themselves to identify, we need to design at this level of sophistication for this particular use case. And here are the limitations of that use case that we need to accommodate into our design process.
So there's a lot of buzz now around design systems. I always read about it. You as Envision also post a lot of thought leadership around that. Could you maybe explain a little bit, what is a design system and why is it so seemingly important or impactful?
Yeah. So I totally agree. I've been in Singapore for the past 3 days, and the majority of my conversations are very heavily centered around design systems, what it means to build a design system, what the value is of doing that. I think the best way to think about a design system is a way of creating order out of chaos, particularly, you know, in the old days, let's say, some of the big organizations we work with today, they had a website, and it was a relatively simple project to do what was then called digital transformation, which was to have a sophisticated web presence, maybe a little bit of personalization, maybe a little bit of like advanced design, but it was somewhat self-contained, and all the elements you were using to form that website and that digital experience were contained within that experience. What's happening now is that if you're looking at, let's say, a DBS bank, which is one of Envision's customers in Asia Pacific, they have numerous different apps. They have numerous different websites for different business lines and different users and different geographies.
Yeah.
And you have multiple disparate teams working on those different projects in different domains. And there is overlap between, from a branding perspective, from a creative perspective, from a design perspective, about the kind of the work that these teams are doing. And it's tremendously wasteful, firstly, if every time you want to recreate a button of a certain type, which is going to be used across DBS's different properties, you have to code that from scratch. So what design system in Envision's world means is essentially a directory of all of your design assets that you can search to find something that's already been created, so you don't have to do it again. The kind of tangential benefit of that, which is very meaningful from a design point of view, is that you drive standardization across your digital experience. We've all, I think, experienced in the process of doing a rebrand, and you know, you go to one website and then you have this new design experience, and then you go to a booking page and suddenly it's, you're taken back to the kind of 2G world with pixels and so forth. And that's a very disjointed experience. And so the kind of demanding modern customer expects a consistent experience across every interaction they have with your brand. And a design system is a very good way of creating kind of standardization in how you present your design assets to anyone on any platform. I think the final thing that I'd say about a design system, about why it's been such a topic of interest for so many people of late, is that one of the big challenges in design in general is this handoff that happens when a designer is finished with an initial prototype or screen design or whatever it might be, and wants to hand that off to their development team to then go and create that. And in the old days, the bad old days, you know, essentially, and if you weren't co-located with a developer, it was very difficult to go and sit next to each other and kind of point to all the things on the screen that you wanted the coder to understand about what it, you know, the nuances of your design and how it needed to render and so forth. With a design system, and this addresses kind of Envision's, one of the biggest growth areas for Envision right now, we are essentially able to pull components into a design system from a developer's code repository. So there is very little opportunity for misinterpretation in the handoff between design and development. And that's just creating tremendous efficiency in how companies that are under tremendous pressure from a digital transformation point of view get to market, and the speed at which they're able to iterate and launch new products. And so I guess standardization, speed to market, collaboration, and efficiency are kind of the key drivers of that conversation. And those are all things that I think we can all agree are very desirable.
Absolutely. I read somewhere that the average Fortune 500 company has something like over 400 touch points out there. So somehow bringing consistency and structure into all of this complexity is tremendously important.
Yeah, that's right. And even for non-technical users, it's very valuable to have a single source of truth as it relates to your company design, how it presents itself. I guess the old days of like the media kit and the kind of brands and icons is now being displaced with this much more sophisticated way of rendering everything you do digitally using a design system.
That sounds like a fantastic tool. What are maybe some of the challenges that people should be aware of before diving in head first?
Yeah, so this has been something I've been talking about all week actually with customers in region. It's adopting Envision at an enterprise level, by which I mean not just having your designers use Envision, but having your business analysts, having your management team, having your legal team, having your UX team, your developers, engineers, quality assurance, all using Envision, is less of a challenge from a functional point of view and more of a challenge from an organizational change point of view. So candidly, there are conversations that I get into with customers where there's clearly strong interest in buying Design System Manager from Envision.
Yeah.
Because they recognize the need that we talk about, that the pain problem that we talk about with a lot of customers, they recognize that in their own company. They can see how using DSM would enable them to solve that problem. So they want to jump headfirst into saying, okay, we're going to buy this product from you. And you know, my responsibility as an MD for Asia Pacific is to make sure that all of our customers not just buy our product, but actually are successful using it. Because it's about context for Envision. It's a very much a land and expand type business where we put in tremendous investment into and also get tremendous benefit from having customers, you know, grow their adoption of Envision within their organization over time. Often the deals we do initially are quite small and then they, you know, mushroom over time into, you know, going organizational wide.
Yeah.
So my responsibility is to make it clear to the customer that this is not going to be a case of, you know, acquiring a license and then solving your problems. A design system is as valuable as the organization is willing to change around it. And what I mean by that is if the developer team isn't willing to rethink the way they work today and, you know, adopt this new methodology that allows them to work more collaboratively with a designer, an investment in a design system will fail. Equally, if you're looking to adopt a design system for use with marketing and non-technical users, or maybe a platform team that's working on your website as a company, but they're not willing to change the way that they work and the way that they interact with their peers in the company, it's also not going to work. And so one of the massively underrated things, I think, in enterprise software in general is just how little of the success comes down to the product, which in most cases is very good, but so much of it comes down to the willingness of the organization to adapt, to accommodate the new way of working that the product used properly can present. And that's particularly more conservative organizations, financial services, transport, government, etc. That can be a more challenging hurdle to overcome. And so we always counsel people that we need to work with you on a plan for how this product's going to be successful from an organizational change point of view before we encourage them to make any investment in it.
That's super interesting. So actually, when we think about then Envision, it's not only like a software or a tool, but it actually brings a new way of working or thinking into an organization.
That's exactly right. And it's changed dramatically because when Envision was founded, that need, it wasn't so apparent. There was some new ways of thinking that Envision entailed for a designer, which, you know, there was a learning curve there and we had customer success folks apply to that. But now, you know, the vision for Envision, I should say, over the next 6 to 12 months is really to move aggressively into areas that are not necessarily design domains today. One of the things that I was completely shocked by when I joined Envision was hearing that actually, only around 30% of the total 5 million users of Envision worldwide are designers. There's a huge number of developers, business analysts, management people, all collaborating and providing feedback on design work that make up the majority of our users. And so, you know, we have a responsibility to make sure that if we are really targeting this kind of enterprise-wide workflow, that we enable that through organizational change, and we have an ability and a rubric and a methodology that is proven to work in other companies so that people have confidence to adopt a product like Design System Manager.
Right. So earlier we touched a little bit on the problems of finding talent, especially in this region here, and also attracting good talent as maybe a company that's perceived as being a bit more old school in industries that are maybe not so fashionable.
Sure.
Is there a hurdle to adopt design systems when you don't actually have an in-house design team? How can organizations deal with that?
Yeah, so one of the things I've been somewhat surprised by since joining Envision and starting work in Asia Pacific is this ability that we have to be successful with customers that don't have an in-house design team. When I first joined the company, my assumption was if we don't have somebody who speaks our language within the organization, we're very unlikely to be able to be really successful in those scenarios.
Yeah.
What I found is that there are companies that we work with extensively in, you know, big organizations in Singapore, for example, where they rely heavily on an agency. And actually, Envision is such a valuable part of that relationship because they're not co-located and they can't walk over all the time to go and talk to their developer as a designer and so forth. It's the classic use case for Envision, which is around collaboration. So we work with one financial services institution in particular, I think of, it works with two very large agencies, and they've adopted 70 enterprise seats for Envision, and those are all primarily being used by their agencies. And then there are a few kind of key stakeholders at the financial services institute organization that, you know, are the kind of, I guess, the linchpin of that relationship. And when the agency produces work, they're able to provide feedback using Envision. It really breaks down that wall between a third party and a first party. And so, you know, we have a use case for that, as well as obviously having an internal collaboration use case where different stakeholders from the business, management, et cetera, can all provide feedback on product development as it happens.
Yeah. And especially, I suppose, when an organization usually works with multiple third parties, not only one, it might actually be a great way to align these different suppliers and agencies to one bigger.
That's right. Yeah. And a standardized way of working, I think, is a very valuable thing for those relationships to thrive with.
Yeah, fantastic. Another big topic that we always hear and talk about is design research, which is incredibly important to actually understand the user, to get new insights. Yet at the same time, organizations don't necessarily seem to really be on that level yet to know, well, what is good practice and why should we actually do this? I mean, in our conversations with clients, it is always a struggle to explain why design research is necessary and why we should spend the time on that. What is your view on that whole topic?
Yeah, so I think that firstly, it's long overdue, this kind of renaissance or this, you know, emergence, I should say, of design thinking and design research as a priority for large organizations, simply because at its core, design research as a subset, I think, of design thinking more broadly, is about empathy and about really understanding the people who use your service. And there are certain things that the market can tell you, and there are certain things that your users can tell you. And I think for the past, you know, let's say 200 years of capitalism, we've indexed very heavily on what the market tells us when we're creating a business rather than what the user's telling us. So I think it's a very exciting time for that reason. And one of my favorite examples that I talk about and the difference between market research and design research is when I was in Tokyo, someone told me the story about Betty Crocker. So I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with Betty Crocker, but I think it's a kind of pre-prepared cake mix brand where, you know, you can make cupcakes and birthday cakes using, you know, adding a couple of eggs and some milk and whisking and putting it in the oven and you're ready.
Right.
Huge business historically in the US in particular and in parts of Europe. And I think in the 60s or 70s, they were looking to enter the Japanese market. The economy was booming in Japan and there was interest in capitalizing on that opportunity. And what the market research was telling them that, you know, for every Japanese household, there is, I don't know, 1.2 rice cookers. So, you know, this is market research telling you that. That's data, that's quantitative data.
Yeah.
The market research also tells you that the Japanese taste for baked goods and cakes is growing exponentially as people develop more of a sweet tooth and more of Western cuisine habits start to become more common in Japanese market. And you pick all these data points out. Betty Crocker, the market research, was very solid behind the idea that they would introduce a cake mix that you would be able to make in your rice cooker. Because you would be, you know, my rice cooker heats up through steam. You can create a cake. It will rise beautifully in your rice cooker. You put it on, you leave it. Very efficient way of baking a cake. And they found a way to make that work using the technology behind a rice cooker, which every Japanese household has or had. Yeah. Market research told them that that was going to be a wildly successful product. If they'd done design research, if they'd done some kind of evaluative research where they were actually watching a user go through the process of baking a cake, what they would have learned is that the rice cooker is a sacred, as close as it comes to the kind of sacred thing within a Japanese home. You don't touch it. You don't wash it with soap. You know, you basically wash it with water. It's unpolluted. Rice has a very significant kind of semi-spiritual meaning in Japanese culinary culture and culture in general. And there was no way in hell that a Japanese person was going to cook a cake in a rice cooker. So despite this huge investment in product development and market entry and so forth, the product was a complete disaster, a complete flop. Nobody bought it. And to me, that's such an interesting example of the difference between market research and design research, because market research is much more quantitative. It's much more focused on data. It's much more focused on how do you grow a business? Whereas design research, there's an assumption that doing right for the user will help to grow a business, but it's all about the user. And it's about understanding, you know, either firsthand through primary research and evaluative research or through kind of secondary research, how they will actually interact with the kind of experience that you put in front of them. So yeah, it's long overdue in my opinion. And I think that there is some complexity around how it's represented as a concept. There's constant branches of design research and design thinking and ways in which it's represented. But at a very fundamental level, it's showing a respect and dignity for your user as the kind of make or break for your success as an organization.
Yeah, it actually feels like such an intuitive thing. No? If you do right by the user, you try to figure out, okay, what do they actually need? You listen to them, try to put them in the center of everything, then you should have a successful product.
Yeah. And I think just on that topic, so why design research in particular and a design thinking mentality is so important is that quite often people will either tell you that they're going to do a certain thing or they themselves believe that they are going to behave in a certain way that they're not actually going to do or behave in.
Yeah.
And they're not lying to you, but they don't understand themselves necessarily as well as they should or might. And so, you know, design research is a really sophisticated, in many cases, it can be a really sophisticated way of finding a solution to a problem that nobody thinks is solvable. Because we are indoctrinated to believe that there is no solution to this problem. Another good example of this, I think it's quite a famous example in relation to design thinking, is a truck, you know, is traveling at 60 miles an hour down the freeway. There's a low bridge and a high truck, and the truck gets stuck under the bridge because it smashes the top of the cabin, and, you know, the truck is stuck there. There's a huge backlog of traffic, and the emergency services all piling in, trying to think about how do we solve this problem? How do we get this truck out of here? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And the police are saying, well, you know, we think we should shave some stone off the bridge to, you know, we can chip away at it and we can create enough space for the truck to get loose. And the fire service is saying, well, you know, we think we should, you know, lop the top off the truck so that the truck can kind of go through. And yes, they'll damage their truck, but it's already damaged anyway, so who cares? And then a little boy comes along and says, well, why don't we just let the air out of the tires? And obviously they do that, and then they're able to move the truck. And it's kind of one of those things where often there's a very simple solution that we are so accustomed by habit to think about problems in a certain way that we never even think of. Right. And quite often, you know, the idea behind design research is that a user will tell you either directly or indirectly what to do if you let them. If you ask them, you might get some insight, but there's real value in letting them show you like how they interact with the experience it is that you're building. And I think that, you know, design as a concept is really about problem solving and making life easier for people. And design research, design thinking plays a big part in that.
I think oftentimes it's also seen as something where even if people understand, they think, okay, design research, that's what designers do.
Hmm.
But who should actually be involved in the research?
Yeah, so it partly depends on the makeup of your organization, right? Because not every company has a product development organization, or not every company has a business analyst organization, whatever it might be. I think that this kind of gets to another bigger topic around at what level should design be represented within a big company, and should it have a C-level representation and so forth. Firstly, I think that any C-level who expresses an interest in design thinking and so forth should be encouraged in that interest by the design organization. I think that the risk for designers in general is that they become very insular and very bound up in their brilliant ideas in many cases. But brilliant ideas will be destined to live in obscurity forever if they're not shared, if they're not bought into by the rest of the organization. And so early on in a design research process, I think to be able to show somebody who's going to have a big impact on product development and prioritization and budget allocation and so forth, how some of those small changes or design work you've been working on can make a big commercial impact, can really make a big difference early on. As with all things, you have to make sure it's not too many cooks in the kitchen and everyone's taking advice from everywhere and nobody's sure about what it is they should be doing. But I think the more buy-in, the better. And I think that, you know, I was talking to somebody at dinner last night who's in a design leadership position about this idea of the seat at the table for design. So the idea being, as more and more organizations start to see the success of the Ubers and the Alibabas and the, you know, the Airbnbs and the Grabs of the world, there's this increasing recognition, not ubiquitous, but increasing recognition at a C-level that, you know, design is really, really something we should take more seriously. And in some cases, that's manifesting as having a design leader represent at the C-level within a big organization. But the problem with that is, you know, having a seat at the table is one thing, but knowing what to say when you get there is another. And one of the things that design thinking in particular, you know, is very important for design thinking is finding a way as a design-oriented person, whether you're an actual designer or a design leader or a UX person or a developer, to be able to communicate on commercial terms with folks who you're trying to get to buy into your vision.
Right.
And so quite often practitioners who are brilliant at their craft want to just do their craft. Frankly, being a chief design officer in a big financial services or other conservative organization is certainly a challenging and interesting job, but it might not be that fun all the time because you're not really doing much designing. You're not doing the thing that brought you into this business in the first place. What you're doing is you're exerting influence on the rest of the organization. Yeah. And so the best people who are able to represent the leadership level, the value of design, have to be able to think in commercial terms about the impact that design can make. They have to understand that their conceptual brilliance is not enough, but they need to understand how to represent outputs and results of their work to the business. And they need to, like all good designers, they need to be able to empathize with, if you're a chief legal officer or chief financial officer and you're asking for, you know, doubling your headcount in design, what can you show that person to help them make sense of why design is valuable from a commercial standpoint?
So that role, if design has a representation on the C-level, is more about evangelizing, about bridging the silos, communicating with other stakeholders, bringing them together to make sure that design is properly embedded in the organization.
I wouldn't say it's completely oriented around that. What I mean is that you can be a chief design officer and still have direct reports who are leaders of design for individual product lines or business lines, and you can be very much involved in the work itself.
Yeah.
But your success or failure in that role, I think, is going to be dictated by nothing, you know, but ultimately it's going to come down to, can you increase the standing and prioritization of design within the organization with folks who aren't necessarily accustomed to working in an organization where design is prioritized? Because your team can love you, the work can be fantastic, you can be a great manager, you can be effective in all kinds of ways as a leader in a business. But in that particular role, you have to recognize that it's a constant uphill struggle.
Yep.
Representing the value of design, and you have to be a very effective influencer within the organization to get others who have a million other priorities to think about design as something that is really has teeth from a commercial standpoint.
Right. Design also is constantly evolving. Somehow we're attaching that word to more and more different topics. Where we came from was UX. Now we're talking about service design. We're talking about business design, organizational design, more and more topics kind of come into the domain of design. Where is that leading to? How is that evolving? How do you see where this is going?
Yeah, so great question. So a lot of the people I've met over the last few days in Singapore started out their career in graphic design. And normally around 1998, 1999, they started doing much more in digital because the internet was starting to explode and the career opportunities were much less oriented around print and much more oriented around this newfangled thing called the internet, which was very cool and was attracting a lot of attention. And that in itself, for a decade or so, was very straightforward. Maybe 10 to 15 years or so was very straightforward in relative terms. Yes, there were new technologies that you had to get used to. You had to get used to how to using things like Photoshop and Illustrator and those early generation of design tools. And that was a new way of thinking, a new way of working for designers. You had to understand the interrelationship between code and design and how that was different from designing for print. But again, it was relatively straightforward just because you were primarily designing for a desktop screen. Or, you know, latterly a mobile screen, but it was a website-based proposition and then, you know, latterly a native application or mobile application proposition. What you're seeing now is that there are so many internet-enabled experiences that really have nothing to do with the screen. So the way in which you're interacting with, you know, a Fitbit or with, you know, your Nest at home if you're in the US or, you know, all these different products that are internet-enabled but aren't really about a classical kind of website design, there's a much more experiential element to that, which is where I think a lot of the focus on experience design as opposed to web design starts to appear. And I think that the experience design piece is so important because the way I experience a brand, for example, is so multifaceted now. It's not just about seeing the billboards and seeing the website and seeing if they line up with each other and where the brand's represented. It's about going on the subway. It's about having cards in my pocket. It's about having, you know, sensors. It's about having numerous different ways of interacting digitally with a brand or a product. And so I think the emphasis on experience design is a recognition that we need to kind of take ourselves out of the monitor and the screen as a concept and understand how the brand is experienced digitally in a kind of mix of analog and digital in the real world.
Right. So on this topic of design thinking, this is something that over the last decade or so has really ballooned into being mentioned everywhere and being on the agenda, at least pro forma, of every organization, also of governments, almost to the point of where it doesn't really mean that much anymore, but I think we vaguely know what we're talking about. Where do you see the limits of design thinking? Somehow everything nowadays is addressed with a design thinking workshop here, a session there, or we need to use design thinking.
Yeah.
Are there actually limits or problems where you'd say, okay, design thinking is not actually going to be useful in those cases, or is it really a cure-all for all the problems an organization has?
Yeah, so it's interesting because as much as I talked about why design the kind of emergence of design research as a discipline has been so valuable in moving towards a real appreciation for the user as a driver of economic growth rather than just the market conditions and what the quantitative research tells you, I think that can be taken too far. So Envision ourselves as a corporation is an interesting example where we could conceivably design the most wonderful user experience for our customers, which is obviously what we're doing every single day. Of course, but we could launch a product that all of our evaluative research, all of our secondary research, all of our primary research tells us is going to be extremely popular with our users, our customers, because it addresses a fundamental problem. It shows empathy in the way it encourages that user to interact with the product, all of that stuff. But the market conditions may also mean that it's going to be commercially unsuccessful. Yeah. So where I think the intersection and the limitations of design thinking are that this idea that a user who is very much a fan of your product and a user who is very loyal to your brand can be a tremendous driver of economic growth. We've seen that in Airbnbs, the Ubers, the Grabs of the world, but it's not sufficient in isolation because that appreciation at user level has to line up with a strong commercial model. It has to look at line up with market conditions. And that's where I think the intersection of market research and design research is important. And I think that also there is this danger with design thinking that, as I say, too many companies, I think, index quite heavily on the primary research and not enough on the evaluative research. So what I tell you may be different from how I actually interact with your product. And so
yeah.
it's very important that the evaluative research where you sit with somebody and have them articulate to you out loud what it is they're doing as they use your product, or observing them as they use your product, is so, so important. And in many cases, I see this all the time with, you know, the worst question you can ask somebody as a commercial or product leader in a software business is, would you pay X for Y? Because inevitably they'll say no, because it's in their self-interest to help you to try and push you to drive down the price. So that's a good example of where somebody might say one thing because they have an agenda in mind, whereas their actual behavior will manifest differently once they have the opportunity to buy that product at that price point. So I think that that's just something that any organization really looking to adopt design thinking has to be careful about. And just one final thing would be, design thinking is meaningful to the extent that it is backed by support from the very top.
Yeah.
I'm a huge believer, and I've seen this in my own career in multiple different contexts, that culture rolls downhill. And even if you have buy-in at the C-level, but the CEO himself or herself isn't bought into the idea that design thinking is going to be valuable, it's very unlikely to be successful permeating through all the different layers within the business. So, you know, I would caution businesses and design folks, design leaders who are trying to drive design, you know, meaningful design thinking orientation within their businesses to really ask the hard questions about what support do I have from the people who control the budgets, from the people who control resource allocation, from the people who prioritize initiatives within the business for the year, because you can be on a hiding to nothing if you are doing brilliant work to help align the folks beneath you around design thinking, but you don't have the support of the folks who make the big decisions that impact your ability to make that change.
So how can designers best make that case? I guess there's a lot of options out there, from showing references from other companies or referring to, for example, there was a McKinsey study that studied the ROI of design, or also, of course, showing your own products. Is there any experience on what is actually most successful in making that argument?
Well, it's interesting because in many respects, a designer is really well placed to figure out that problem because they are trained in empathic thinking. They're trained in understanding their user. And in a kind of roundabout way, I think that if I was a design leader at a large bank, for example, in Singapore, you know, I would want to understand particularly what the CFO or the chief product officer or chief digital officer felt was a priority for the business this year.
Yeah.
I'd want to understand how they intended to measure that, the impact of the success with that those initiatives or that initiative. And then I'd be reporting to them on a weekly or monthly basis about the success of the work that I was doing and my team was doing relative to what they were focused on and the metrics that they were reporting on. And as soon as you do that, you become part of the solution and you become part of the team that's solving for their biggest priorities. It's all very well to say, well, I think this is what we should be doing as a business. And, you know, this is what the user's telling me. But if you can't take those people along on that journey with you, you're going to be severely resource constrained because after some time, the funding's going to dry up. The people aren't going to be representing you at the right level to the board and so forth and the work that you're doing. And just the messaging coming out of the company updates and the, you know, CEO communication and so forth isn't going to be oriented around design, and you're not going to feel that kind of groundswell of support for that way of thinking within the org.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good point. Instead of looking at stakeholders as kind of adversaries, which sometimes people do, look at them as another type of user and apply that empathy that you're supposed to have.
Yeah, no, it's all very, you know, sadly, within a corporate context, obviously it's different for individuals. You know, individual artists can make very, very, very successful by just through, you know, sheer value of their craft and their innate talent and ability. But for anyone operating in a corporate context, it's very, very challenging to have a big impact when you're doing brilliant work, unless that brilliant work is lining up with the goals of the folks who, you know, decide how much support you're going to get from the organization.
Yeah. So at Envision, how do you create empathy for your users? How do you decide what to build next?
Yeah, so we have a couple of different means of doing that. We have something called a Design Leadership Forum. A Design Leadership Forum is a group of design leaders and design adjacent leaders, let's call it, folks who exist in within our hemisphere. As I said, only 30% of users within Envision are actually designers, who have real experience solving some of the biggest challenges that Envision is trying to solve on behalf of the end user as well as the customer itself. And we have dinners with those folks. We have opportunities for them to provide product feedback to our product organization that kind of informs our prioritization and our product roadmap. Because to the point about empathic design and evaluated design, if we don't understand how our customers are actually using our product and the gaps that they are in the product that they want to see addressed, we're not going to be able to continue to grow our business effectively.
Yeah.
We do NPS surveys like every other software company, and that's actually really valuable because for those of the listeners who are not familiar with NPS, but essentially on a semi-regular basis, I think in Envision's case, twice a year, we will email every single one of our primary contacts to the customer. And we'll ask them how likely, it's a very simple one question survey, which is how likely are you to recommend Envision to a colleague or friend or something along those lines. And there's a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being not at all likely and 10 being very likely. And there's also an opportunity in a field underneath having answered the question to provide any comments that you want. And so twice a year, you know, we really go into overdrive on a big initiative around calling anyone who gives us less than an 8 or a 9, I think it is, and understanding more deeply why it is that they're maybe not as satisfied as we'd like them to be.
Yeah.
We use that data to inform product decisions. So we know, for example, if somebody's using one of our particular products and there's a pattern showing that those users are less happy than we'd ideally like them to be, you know, that may be a weakness in our strategy. And so we are not perfect by any means, but I think we take very seriously having our ear to the ground, gathering primary, secondary, evaluated research from our customers and giving them a voice at the product development level, because they tell us things all the time that we would never have thought of that become to seem incredibly obvious once they articulate them.
How many designers actually work at Envision?
That's a really good question. So I'm 6 weeks into Envision, so I certainly haven't met all of them. We do have a lot of folks who have transformed their career through design to end up at Envision in various different roles. So we have a guy called Richard Banfield, who's our head of design transformation and vice president of the company. And he had his own agency for many years. He was living design on the front line, working with customers and so forth. And he's now in a role where he's very consultative, working with the Lloyds banking groups and the Citi groups and the Walmarts and the biggest Envision customers worldwide to provide that extra level of expertise for them as they think about big investments in design and digital. And Aaron Walter, who was, I think, the VP in charge of UX at MailChimp, a big software company, US-based. And Aaron is now our VP of design education. So he runs all of our enablement resources, our designbetter.co community. He hosts our podcast and so forth. So there's a lot of folks who've started out as designers and ended up at Envision contributing back to the design community in different ways. And then obviously we have within our product organization, we take our own design of our own product very, very seriously. So yeah, we have some of the world's best designers working within our product organization, because if we can't create a best-in-class product experience, who can? You know, that's a reasonable expectation that our customers would have given our focus on that in the market.
So do you have a design system?
Absolutely. Yeah. I will say that I've worked at companies in the past where we don't use our own product, and it's always incredibly disheartening because you think, I'm out here trying to represent to the market how great this product is and we're not even using it ourselves, which is just lazy. But Envision, absolutely. We use Envision for product development. We use Envision for collaborative ideation. We use Envision for design system management. We're very proud to be users of our own platform and to have built 100 million plus business on the back of the use of that platform. And we, you know, the message to our customers is, you know, small or large, you can enact that kind of change using Envision, and we're the proof.
And as an organization, it's actually also very interesting because it's pretty decentralized.
It is, yeah. So I was talking about this at dinner last night. For the listeners who aren't aware of Envision, one of the unique characteristics of Envision is that it's a fully remote company. We have 850 plus people around the world. We have the classic kind of map that you see in every organization of where everyone's located, and it's much more scattered than you typically would expect. Normally you get a big concentration on the west coast of the US, the east coast of the US, London, Singapore, Sydney, etc. Whereas we have people all over the place. And a little bit of background on that. So Clark, who started the company, the founder and CEO of the company, lives in Brooklyn. And yeah, it became very clear to him early on that to get the best of the best talent into Envision, to build the kind of company that he wanted to build, it was just going to make it unnecessarily difficult if he had to move to Silicon Valley and compete with the Dropboxes and the Ubers and everybody else for that expensive and, you know, highly capable design UX development talent. And he had this epiphany there just around the time Envision was launching, was also the kind of early rise of the productivity tools, the Zooms, the Slacks, the, you know, Asana, Trello, Jira, etc. So we benefited tremendously from this kind of momentous shift in the market for remote collaboration tooling. But Clark started Envision in a way that was very oriented around remote work. And I think it's tremendously difficult to create a remote organization if your people have the muscle memory of going to an office, because the ways in which you think are all oriented around co-location, whereas Envision had the benefit from day one of being fully remote. So we designed everything in the way we organizational structure, in terms of our collaboration tooling, in terms of, you know, our reporting structures and our communication protocols and so forth around remote work. And when I was, it's interesting, when I joined Envision, I was in onboarding in my first week. And one of the things I remember them telling me is that in a fully remote environment, you need to be 20% nicer than you think you need to be when you communicate. And that's really stuck with me ever since, because I'm not by any means a flamethrower when it comes to the way I communicate. I think I'm quite gentle, but, you know, obviously communicating via Slack and Zoom and things with people who in many cases you kind of know really well because you speak to them a lot, but you've never met face to face. There's a lot that can be lost in context there in how we communicate. So we put a very, very strong premium on, you know, getting to know the individual as much as you can, despite not being face to face, before asking for something. That's one of the other things that I was guided on, and just imbuing as much context as you can into the way you communicate, and being uncharacteristically, in some cases, or unusually kind in the way you think about how you communicate with your colleagues. And that's created actually a very special culture where people always ask about the downside, right? They always ask about what's it like to have no offices and what's it like to never see people and so forth. But the reality is that firstly, not paying millions of dollars in rent for expensive real estate all around the world enables us to do other things. So we bring everyone together twice a year, once in Arizona with the whole company goes. And then actually next week, I'm going to London for our mid-year get together where we do skills training for everyone across the team and product updates. And the American team will be in Denver for that. So we spend the money that we save on creating a very rich kind of environment around remote work.
Yeah.
And I will say that it has been a tremendous asset for us from a hiring perspective, because, you know, we have access to people who live in Wyoming and who live in Perth and who live in rural areas who have these skills, because for whatever reason, they've gone back to look after parents or they've ended up living where they live. And being able to hire those people, the best of the best, wherever they are, A, gives us a huge competitive advantage. I think B, it creates a more equitable and inclusive organization, because if you, for example, are a working parent who is coming back into the workplace, not losing 2 hours of your day every single day to a commute is very valuable, and also gives you more flexibility around picking up kids and, you know, doing all the things that come with being a working parent. So there are just so many advantages that it's always interesting to me that everyone always asks kind of nervously about what it's like, but actually it's just awesome.
Great. Yeah, I guess it's still quite unusual, but probably a model that is going to work better and better with all the technology that you also referenced that we're putting in place.
Yeah. Zoom
including,
is the,
of course, also Envision itself.
Yeah. Zoom is the first stock that I ever bought. First individual stock. I've been investing in ETFs for a long time, but first individual stock I ever bought. I generally subscribe to the philosophy that you can't beat the stock market when you try and pick stocks. So that's why I've mostly focused on ETFs for investment. But with Zoom, I just felt so strongly that, like, there is so much room to grow in this market. And my own experience working at Envision was such that, you know, I can see firsthand that this is the coming wave and this is how the world is going to change. And it's been a very good investment for me so far.
Yeah, I found it super interesting that in, you know, 2018, 2019, there is still room to actually build a solid video conferencing software and actually turn it into a unicorn, which is a problem we should have solved a
long time ago. But it's not it's one of those kind of duck technologies where what you see on the surface is a very calm, smoothly sailing, bird. And what you see beneath the surface is frantic paddling. And I think the infrastructure challenges of building video conferencing with, you know, high performance and multi-user collaboration and so forth is tremendous. And I think that it's so fascinating to me that Zoom have done such a fantastic job of that in a market that for decades, as you say, has been trying to figure out how to improve the product experience.
Yeah, there's always space for something new.
That's right.
On that note, what's next for InVision? Are there any trends that you're looking to support with new tools? Is there any area that you're looking into?
Yeah, so firstly, I think we are really doubling down on investment in the design community. One of our big competitive advantages over the last 8 years has been the association with InVision as a cornerstone of the design community.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, without wishing to blow our own trumpet, we have invested vast sums of money and vast amounts of effort into providing a really meaningful collection of resources for the design community, podcasts, case studies, design education. We have a $5 million design scholarship fund. We have the design exchange program, which is coming to Sydney in October, where we fly leaders from businesses in the US to come and meet with their counterparts in Asia. We're all in. And that investment is going to continue to grow because we believe it's very important that InVision doesn't stand alone as a product, but is the center of a community. And we kind of lead the agenda on how the world is thinking about design. I think the second big thing that InVision's working on is a way of articulating what are today a number of different products into a new way of thinking about InVision as a platform rather than a collection of products. And what I mean by that is today, as I said, we have design system manager for design systems. We have Inspect for the design developer handoff. We have Studio for screen design. We have Craft for pulling information in from Sketch and so forth. And this has grown a lot over the last few years, the full extent of our product range. What we're really focused on, I think, in the next 12 months or so is telling that story for organizations that have fatigue from all these small point solutions popping up across their organization and want to be able to find a solution that they can standardize on for their entire workflow and all of their kind of design adjacent users. And we're seeing great reception to that. Actually, the last couple of days in Singapore, some of these big organizations in particular, they know they can't be successful getting the legal teams and the product teams and the developer teams and everything else adopting a design-based workflow if they asked to learn and use six different tools for different contexts. They know that adopting a single workflow enabled by a single platform is the way to go to drive real, meaningful transformation at the enterprise level. And so at the same time, we're seeing a proliferation of smaller functional design tooling appear. We're doubling down on that vision for how do we enable the entire workflow for design thinking within an organization and not just the designer themselves, as important as that persona will obviously continue to be for InVision.
Fantastic. That sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
All the best with the future of the development here in APAC and of course, for InVision globally.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost in Transformation with our host Sebastian from Ming Labs. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe to our channel and leave us a review on iTunes. Join us next time for another episode of our podcast.